Welcome to Socrates in the Studio, which falls under the aegis, but not today under the rubric of Socrates in the City. Today, the city in which we find ourselves is New York City, and my guest is Paul Kingsnorth. He is a novelist, a poet, and an essayist. He's been dubbed furiously gifted by the Washington Post, but what do they know? Let's be honest. Today, we're going to be discussing his book, Against the Machine, on the Unmaking of Humanity. I've read it. It's excellent. I'm excited to talk to Paul Kingsnorth about it. If you've watched Socrates in the Studio, you know I've interviewed Ian McGilchrist. He had this to say about Paul Kingsnorth's book. The most powerful and important book I've read in years. This book should be required reading not only for politicians, technocrats, teachers, and all who help shape our world, but for every still living soul in this terrifying age of the machine. Wow. Paul Kingsnorth, wonderful to have you with us. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I said to you before we started that, you know, not only have I read the book, but I had a curious experience reading the book because I thought, I think along the lines of what you say in here very, very much. I've not written a book about it, but it was an extraordinary thing to read your explication of what I have felt intuitively and sometimes not so intuitively. So for those who don't know anything about you or your thesis, what is the thesis of Against the Machine on the Unmaking of Humanity?
Well, this is really a book that comes at the end of about a 30-year process of trying to work out what the heck is going on in the modern world.
Would this be your 30-year process?
This would be my 30-year process, perhaps starting from the same sort of intuition that you have, which I've had since I was a young man, that I look around the world we're in, I feel that there's something very broken about the values of it. The things that I feel intuitively connected to, human-scale culture, the natural world especially, a sense that there's something essential in humanity seems to me to be being stripped away and replaced by something technocratic. And really the thesis of the book is that over a period of modern history in the Western world, particularly over the last few hundred years, we have created a particular system of thinking, a way of seeing and a way of being, which is quite revolutionary in human history, which views the earth primarily as a mechanism rather than an organism, which is replacing, say, a religious worldview, a Christian worldview, particularly in the West, with a theology of technical progress, and which is effectively moving towards a place where we are, well, put it this way, we've been conducting a 200 or 300 war against nature, and the last place that war goes is a war against human nature. So we're now moving very rapidly into a place where not only are we now conducted by and controlled by and corralled by our technologies in a way that we find it almost impossible to escape, something that's happened very rapidly, but we're now moving into the age of artificial intelligence, the age of supposed uploading of minds and creating giant superhuman intelligences. We are attempting to replace nature with technology, and we are, as the subtitle of the book suggests, actually unmaking ourselves in a really fundamental way. So the exploration, I would say the book is more of an exploration than a thesis. It's an exploration of this process. What is actually going on here? Is there something wrong? Where did it come from? Where does it take us if it keeps going in this direction? And if we don't like the direction, what can we actually do about it? So a series of very big questions that I'm trying to sort of summarize. So I'm trying to tell a historical journey of where this thing I call the machine came from and why we feel, or certainly I feel, that we're living in a world in which we're cogs in something rather than...
I think people who don't feel it are going to go out on a limb and say that people who don't feel this are idiots. And we'll be exploring that in the course of this conversation. I think most people, anyone thoughtful, does feel this. The question is, what about it? I think some people would really do thoughtlessly say it's a good thing, but you have to be pretty thoughtless to say it's a good thing without at least some caveats. But what was it that led you to write the book? Because you've written many books, but this is...
I've written a lot of books, which almost all of my books touch on this story in some way. So I've written three novels, a couple of poetry collections, some travel books, which are really political travel books, examining the impact of globalization. I wrote a whole book about local culture in England, where I come from, and how that was being destroyed and replaced by the system of globalization. All of those are really getting at the same question. What is it that seems to be stripping away our sense of human scale culture and our sense of humanity and our relationship with nature and our traditions and our God, and replacing them with this giant thing? So these essays started to come about. I started writing them, as ironically, as essays on the internet, on Substack, during the COVID pandemic, and that really accelerated my question about how technology can be used to sort of corral mass populations. But we were also living in the middle of a culture war, and I looked at the culture war and I said, what's the actual culture that we're having a war over here? If we're going to fight about the West, what do we mean by that? Where do we come from? What is the culture of modernity, and why does it seem to be replaced by technology? So, as I said, it's the culmination of a kind of 30-year question, and I thought it was about time I tried to pin down what was actually going on. I call it the machine because it's a phrase I've used that I've taken from greater writers than myself. It's a phrase that's been used by everyone from Mary Shelley to George Orwell to D.H. Lawrence. Many of these writers are quoted in the book to describe the feeling that this thing is closing in around us and has been so since the Industrial Revolution. And I think you're right. Everybody can feel this. And actually, just in the last few years, I meet far fewer people who are sort of willing to unquestioningly defend progress, because except in Silicon Valley, there's hardly anyone left who doesn't look around them and think something's wrong, even if they don't know what it is. And I'm trying to write this book to try and explain what it is, at least from my perspective. If you don't like the perspective, you can argue with it. But at least I'm trying to ask the questions. How did this thing happen? How did we become so dehumanized by our technologies that we feel like we're not free human beings anymore?
Well, it's interesting because people have been having the same conversation for decades, but it was never so outrageously obvious and clear. I mean, it was always more theoretical. I mean, people made films about this in the 60s, the mechanization of culture, and we're all becoming cogs, and I've got a job at IBM, and I'm a nobody, and I'm looking for real meaning, something transcendent. That's been around, but never has it hemmed us in as it's now done, so that now it's inescapable. Everyone has their phone. They're connected to infinity at their fingertips. This is a new experience, and it seems to have accelerated dramatically in the last, let's say, 5 years.
Yeah, completely. Well, what we're seeing now is the end point of where progress was always going to take us. So, I mean, we were talking about this before we came on air, actually. The whole of the ecosystem of, say, 20th century science fiction writing is all about where we are now. What happens when the machines become intelligent? What happens when we live in space or attempt to live in space? What happens when we are so controlled by our technologies that we become inhuman? What can we do about that? So the whole thing is filled with, so many films and novels are filled with these partly warnings, but partly explorations of where we're going to go when this happens. And as you say, and just in the last 5 years, the last 10 years, when we've all been completely tied into our phones, everyone's tied into digital technology.
Yeah.
It's impossible to live without the internet.
Right.
And now we have AI. And if even half of what the AI boosters say is going to happen happens, we're moving very, very fast, like in a few years, into a period in which we have super intelligences. But not only that, we find it impossible to know what reality actually is. Right? We're already at that point. You can watch a film. Is it a real film? Has AI made the film? You can talk to someone on the phone. Are they a real person? Is it a robot? What is reality? We've been living on screens for so long that we've almost slid effortlessly into this world in which we mediate reality through screens. And a whole generation of kids has grown up thinking this is totally normal.
Right.
I mean, people like you and me, right? We're probably, I would guess, old enough to have grown up before the internet, right? But my children aren't.
Yeah.
So if you've grown up with this stuff, you have a real problem understanding what reality even is. And if we're moving into an age now where we're very consciously trying to make machines that behave like gods, which is the way these guys who are building them talk, then you're in uncharted waters. So you're right. This has been the end point that things have been building up to for couple of hundred years, actually, but now we're at the point where we can see what it looks like.
I was a little bit surprised in the course of reading the book not to find you mentioning C.S. Lewis, because his book, That Hideous Strength, and other things that he writes, The Abolition of Man and other things, seem prophetically to be pointing toward what you're discussing in the book.
Yeah, totally. I think I did quote him at one point. One of my favorite Lewis quotes is that human nature will be the last part of nature to fall to man, and the battle will then have been won. The question is who precisely would have won it. So Lewis is a very prophetic voice. This Hideous Strength is one of those sci-fi novels I was talking about, actually, written in the 1950s, absolutely pointing to where we are now. and The Abolition of Man is basically a non-fiction version of that book,
right,
which he said himself.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, there are so many writers I could have written about.
Yeah, but the thing is, Paul, that you... what needs to be said, I think, which if someone reads That Hideous Strength or they read your book, what we're talking about is something that is undeniably creepy, unheimlich, uncanny. I would say it smells evil. There's something about it which seems, at least as I felt it intuitively, to be at war with humanity and with God. You can sense it. And that's what I find interesting, is that there are many people who ordinarily wouldn't use that kind of vocabulary, but they themselves have a sense of it. In other words, it whatever this is makes you suddenly aware of your humanity, and that there's something that, I mean, you say in your subtitle, On the Unmaking of Humanity. That to me, when I read Perelandra, C.S. Lewis's second in his Ransom trilogy, the unman is that. It's what happens when we begin to unravel, to be atomized, to be less than human. That seems to be the process you're getting at in this book.
I think, speaking of C.S. Lewis, I was wondering just the other day what would happen if the Screwtape letters were written now, and what advice Screwtape would give to his nephew about using the internet. Right? Get them on phones all the time. Get them on their screens all the time. That's the best way to take them away from God. That's the best way to shatter their attention. That's the best way to get them addicted to pornography and gaming and lust and greed and all the other things that we want them addicted to. If you were the devil, you would definitely invent the internet, put it that way. I sometimes look at the internet as a giant Ouija board that kind of summons things through its nodes. But it's a really good point. And one of the things I'm trying to wrestle with in this book, and I don't really know the answer to this. There's a couple of chapters on this in the book. What are the spiritual implications of digital technology especially? If you listen to the people in Silicon Valley and the language that they use, not all of them obviously, but a lot of them, they use very, very openly theological language to talk about what they're doing. And again, a lot of this is quoted in the book. These people say that when they're talking about AI, that they are building God, that they are making God. When Ray Kurzweil from Google, the great prophet of the singularity, was asked, does God exist? He said, not yet. So this is the vision that they have. Similarly, when Ezra Klein at the New York Times went and asked a load of AI developers, given that you keep warning us that this stuff is so dangerous, why are you developing it? They couldn't answer the question, but he said they felt like they had an obligation to usher this new intelligence into the world. Right. So these people are summoning something.
Yeah, they're not going to actually say, I've sold my soul to the devil.
Well, that would be another way of putting
it,
yeah.
Because that would be very unpleasant for them to admit or to acknowledge even to themselves.
But it has the same feeling behind it.
Sure.
And you're right, there's a spiritual darkness to it, which everyone can feel, and it's one reason why people feel so discomforted, because it's not just about, oh, I'm using my phone a bit too much, I should probably put it down. There is something that feels like we're being unmade going on, and I don't think it's
unmade.
Just me being paranoid.
And that's an interesting word. I mean, to unpack that word, if we're created by God, there's something irreducible about us. In other words, to have a soul, to be made in the image of God, is to be irreducible. And it seems to me that the things that you talk about in the book are attempts to reduce us, to atomize us, to fracture us, and then to atomize us so that we aren't a holistic thing, an integrated thing, but some kind of agglomeration of connected bits, which is different. And it seems to me it's sort of the unraveling. I don't know. I'm trying to think of an image, but that's the impression you get, that it's doing something which is at warring with the very core of what it is to be human, which I guess requires us to then try to define, what does it mean to be human? What is it that we sense is being warred upon?
Well, I think what you've got with the technological system that we have now is a kind of bait and switch. It promises to make you more fully human and actually makes you less human in a fundamental way, because it disintegrates your attention. It takes you away from nature. I mean, if you're walking around doing this all day, which most people in this city and everywhere else in the world currently are, you're not looking into the eyes of other human beings. You don't know how to speak to them. You're not sitting around a table eating with them. If you're spending 9 or 10 hours a day on your phone, which many people are, the average for children is terrifying, from the age of about two, which is when kids get screens now, you are being taken out of basic human relationships and you're being unmade. There's a little formula I come up with in the book when I'm trying to work out how we might define a living human culture. And I talk about the four P's, which are kind of like the four legs of a table that you could say culture was based on. They are people, place, prayer, and the past. And I would say that every real human culture around the world, whatever kind of culture it is based on those four legs. So you have your people, which is a sense of the community you're part of, that you have human relationships with. Then you have your place, that's the part of the natural world that you're in, that you have a relationship with, that you understand, that you maybe grow your food on. You have prayer, that's your direct relationship to God. And you have the past, which is your sense of where you come from, a tradition that you're passing on to your children. If you look at what technology does, it unmakes all of those things. Okay, so it takes you away from nature, it shoves you into your screen instead, usually in a giant mega city surrounded by other flickering screens. It certainly takes your attention away from God. I mean, the very act of prayer and contemplation in a religious tradition is impossible if you've had your head fragmented by 5 hours on a smartphone. Try bringing it back together again to focus on anything. The past is effectively unmade. We're removed from any sense that there is any continuity in human culture because everything's broken now by the machine. We're all just moving forward into the same thing. And then you have... what have I done? I've done people, place, prayer, and the past. Yes, place. So anyway, whichever ones I've done and which ones I haven't done, I've lost track. All of these things are unmade
place,
by the kind
place
of...
place is important place. Well, because place is, to be grounded in a place.
If you grow up in a place, say, and that place maybe is the place that your children will then live in, then you're rooted in something. So all of this thing is... what the machine is doing is ripping up all of our roots all the time, unmaking us in these basic ways and giving us instead this promise of a kind of perpetual present. Right. So we all live in this wonderful globalized system and we tell ourselves how great it is that we can talk to people on the other side of the world on Zoom and we can text this and we can see that. We keep up with everything that's going on everywhere and it's always sold to us as connection. But it's not connection, it's disconnection because we disconnect ourselves from the actual physical act of real things. And so it promises us a fuller version of our humanity whilst actually, I think, uprooting the things that make human life actually meaningful.
There's nothing new under the sun. I mean, when I read the book, I thought to myself, we've seen this, you know, we don't need to go back to the Garden of Eden, but we could. But the serpent's lies... But we can just start at the French Revolution. Suddenly, there's this promise of utopia to wipe away the past, to remake everything. So it's a utopianist scheme that is simultaneously kind of a Tower of Babel, the idea that we can make our way into the heavens on our own, that we can achieve divinity, some kind of divinity. So when you mention Kurzweil and you mention... sometimes they talk about it explicitly, sometimes they don't, but they're all aiming at the same kind of thing. But when we look at the past, we know that every time these things have been promised, they have ended in some kind of horrific bloodbath rather than the promised utopia.
Well, speaking of the Garden of Eden, the most recognizable logo related to modern technology is an apple with a bite taken out of it. That's not a coincidence. Yeah, so the French Revolution and many of the revolutions, especially of the left in the 20th century, are political manifestations of this kind of ideology of flattening, like you say, utopia. You create a perfect world, everyone's equal, everything's the same, there's no injustice, it's going to be perfect. And of course it isn't perfect because it's not possible to do it because we're all made of crooked timber and so you do end up with gulags and death camps and massacre of the peasants in the Vendée and the rest of it. And it is exactly an attempt to kind of immanentize the eschaton, almost, you know, to create this utopia on Earth. Technology is almost, I think, the next stage of that process. So the 20th century is the age of ideology, right? So you have Marxist revolutions, Bolshevik revolutions, and you have fascist and Nazi revolutions, and they're all actually attempts to create this utopia on Earth. And they all fail, and millions end up dead. Now we're doing it through technology instead. We're going to use technology to interconnect everyone, technology to... replace everything and flatten it out. I've had conversations with transhumanists who very openly say, look, we need to replace the whole of nature with technology. Nature is unjust. Human life is unjust. Death is unjust. Nobody should get sick. It's not fair. If we use technology to effectively rebuild the entire world, we can create that paradise. We can live forever. You take the Christian story, which actually is the basis of our culture, and you turn it into a technological story. We replace God. We don't have to, you know, try and go to the kingdom of heaven after our death. We create it here. We use it with technology to do it. We upload our minds into a silicon heaven. All of this stuff is seriously discussed. So technology is the latest manifestation of that desire for a utopian paradise on earth.
You use the phrase immanentize the eschaton. I can never remember who said it first. William F. Buckley made it famous.
Yeah.
Your pronunciation of it sounds nicer. But
probably wrong.
It's what we're talking about, to immanentize the eschaton. We've seen in the past, as you said, but now we're seeing the same thing for the first time via technology. Mm. And I think, again, most thoughtful people are at least a little bit frightened by it because we don't know where it's going. And the people who are driving it seem to be especially thoughtless about where it's going. They don't seem to posit the possibility that it may not be going to a great place.
Well, I think that's really interesting. So on the one hand, I think most people don't even know what's happening. We all just get swept along with whatever device comes along next. So nobody was ever given the chance to think about whether they would like to live in a world in which everyone has a smartphone, and they have to have one, right? Because we've got to the point now where it's almost impossible to live without a phone. There was no discussion about that. It was just launched on us. The thing was created, and we were sucked into it. And people just kind of go along with it because everyone else goes along with it because you have to go along with it. I mean, I don't have one, so you can avoid them, but it's harder and harder to do it. So you can sort of resist for a while, but the system sweeps you along. And I don't think most people think about or know about the ideas behind it or the direction it's going in. They don't have any particular reason to. But as I say, when you listen to the guys in Silicon Valley, you see two things. Firstly, a lot of them do actually have a very specific, quite religious vision. They're moving towards transhumanism, they're trying to make God, or they're trying to create God, or they're trying to create great superhuman minds which are going to take over what humans do and do them better. I've heard a lot of arguments that we won't need politicians anymore because we'll have AIs running things in a logical and calmer manner. I mean, I can see the attraction. You know, some of us, when we look at our politicians, maybe we find that attractive.
Yeah.
But, you know, but it's a utopian vision. It's important to understand that a lot of this technology comes from people who are extremely utopian. And who really believe that this is going to save the world. But at the same time, the very disturbing thing to me at the moment is the people who are developing the AI systems in particular are the same people warning us about the AI systems. So Geoffrey Hinton, the British godfather of AI, as he's called, was one of the early developers of it, gave an interview about a week or two ago in which he said he thought that AI had a 20% chance of causing total human extinction. And he said it in a very kind of English way, so it was all very polite and downbeat, you know. And he was sort of apologising for it. You know?
It really sounds like a Monty Python sketch.
It does, I know. But the people who are, I mean, again, there are examples of this in the book, the people who are calling for a moratorium on AI are often the AI developers. So they develop this stuff. It's an Oppenheimer situation, right? They get us to the point where this stuff comes into the world, and then suddenly they go, oh, hang on, it's going to kill everybody. So there's a strange thing going on where they, on the one hand, this group of people who are pushing this in the direction think this is going to lead to a utopia. On the other hand, they're the ones who are scared of it because they can already feel like it's getting out of their control. So if they feel like that, the rest of us have got good reason to worry about it. But
well, I mean, what it can do in a positive way is force us to think about some things, basically, and to think about what does it mean to be human. The secular robots who seem to be thoughtlessly moving along with this. They don't have a biblical worldview. And of course that's strike three right out of the gate, because as a Christian I would say, you know, mankind is fallen and therefore we have to beware of what's possible. Just because we can do things doesn't mean we ought to do them. And at least I have some kind of a basis on which to think about whether something's worth doing. But these folks don't seem to do that. Or let's say this, they seem to have the preposterously naive idea that that's not even worth considering, that wherever we're going is wonderful, and you're foolish to think about it in other ways. They don't seem to have any sense of history or the story of humanity, which we call history.
Well, I think they're children of the modern revolution in the sense that they believe that the progress of science and technology and rational thinking and utopian thinking has replaced the superstitions of religion and the other things that we used to have that we've now superseded. We know that they're not true because science can't demonstrate them to be true. And so all that you have left is a kind of materialist strata of you know, the world is just a thing that we have a duty to manage. And it's almost as if you see the world in that way, you do have a duty to do it, right? And if you have the ability to manage the entire world, if you could recreate nature, if you could prevent aging and prevent death, well, that would be a good thing. That would create more happiness, create more pleasure. They're very big on reducing suffering. Most people want to reduce suffering to some degree, but again, the Christian story will tell you that some degree of suffering is necessary for you to actually struggle against. And because we're fallen creatures, we're imperfect creatures, and so if an imperfect creature who is not fully formed or fully functioning attempts to create a utopia, well, what's going to happen? Well, we know what's going to happen because it's happened already many times, and we're just doing the same thing with technology. So as much as anything, one of the themes of the book is our refusal to accept limits, which I think is the big story of modernity, and especially technological modernity. The story we tell, the story of progress, is that all limits are there to be broken. Right, so cultural limits, we break them. Physical limits, we break them. We break the limits that nature puts upon us and our relationship with it. We push forward all the time, and we bust through limits, and we never stop. And there's no sense that there is a place at which you should stop doing that.
Well, that's kind of the irony, is that these people have adopted that idea as a religion, but they're unaware. Or they're, at least they're not. Maybe they're not brave enough to admit that it's a religion. To say that transgression for its own sake is good, rebellion for its own sake is good, it's not particularly rational. But worse than being not particularly rational, it rather blithely assumes that that is true with no evidence. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that it's not true. But they really seem to have taken this as an article of faith, that transgression for its own sake is good. It's a Promethean thing. You referenced the apple with the bite out of it. This idea that, or you could say it's Luciferian, but it really is, it seems to have at its heart the desire to supplant God, to say that I want to crawl into heaven and murder God and be God, which of course we hear for the first time in the first pages of Genesis, to be as gods. That seems to be at the heart of this project. And so therefore, rebellion for its own sake or transgression for its own sake is to them an unmitigated good.
It is, and it is the oldest story, which is why, although this technological machine that we've created over the last couple of hundred years is a new thing in many obvious ways, the impetus behind it is not a new thing. As you say, you could go back to the book of Genesis. You can see the story of choosing to be as gods. You can look at Greek myth and you can see Prometheus. You can see these kinds of stories in the kind of creation myths of many different cultures, actually. Humanity attempting to rebel against God or the gods and replace them. And so in that sense, it's a really old desire that we have within us, which clearly humans around the world have been able to see for a long time. What we've got now is the technological ability to try and do it, which we've never had before, at least on this scale. I mean, once we could build a tower to the heavens and God could kind of scatter us into different languages, which is obviously the Babel story in the book of Genesis. But what we're doing now is building a digital tower of Babel on a scale that we've never been able to do before. One of the quotes I have right at the beginning of the book is from Arthur C. Clarke, the great British sci-fi writer, who says that it may be that our purpose on this planet is not to worship God, but to create him. Right, so that's the worldview of Silicon Valley right there. And that's what we will try to do. Ultimately, the end point of this rebellion against nature, rebellion against human nature, rebellion against culture, is to attempt to replace God. It's a radically new thing and also the oldest thing. It's just, in a way, it's just the latest manifestation. And like all the other manifestations, I think it probably ends up getting scattered.
Let's hope so. But
maybe not yet. The question is how far it goes before
comes down. But again, the thoughtlessness, the hubris of these folks, it really cracks me up. It's an amazing thing to see people be so intoxicated with their own abilities that they're not more thoughtful.
Yeah, and again, as I say, though, I think there's a quote in the book from the great transhumanist Zoltan Istvan, who started his own transhumanist party, actually, and stood as a presidential candidate a few years ago.
Well, you know, with a name like Zoltan, well, he kind of has to do that.
It's a great transhumanist name, isn't it? Zoltan Istvan. It's like a sci-fi name. But I had a conversation with him, and he said, look, we have a moral duty to replace the whole of nature with technology to ensure that everybody can live forever, to ensure that there is no suffering, because the world is unjust and it's full of misery and suffering and it's not fair, and we need to make it fair and we need to use technology to do that. So that's extremely hubristic, but also extremely moralistic. You know, a lot of these people have this moralistic vision. It's not just about, hey, let's make a ton of cash by selling iPhones.
Yeah.
It's like, this is the way we can reduce suffering.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's almost got a nobility to it. You know, they're trying to do something.
Well,
good.
The
hubris is there at such a powerful degree that they really do believe, or at least some of them, the more extreme level, believe that, yeah, we can replace nature. We can live forever. We can build God. We can upload our minds. So they think they have God-like powers, and that's where the fool comes in again.
Well, one of the things you talk about in the book, which I would quibble with, is the way you talk about capitalism as part of this. I think that capitalism can be bad, but it needn't be bad if we have a sense of our limits and a sense of what it is. I mean, I would say that it's neutral, but it can act in such a way, if we're not aware of its limits, that it can be very dangerous. I don't know if you want to...
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely somewhere we were going to disagree, I think, because I see, it depends what you mean by capitalism, but I'm looking at this as, I try and trace the beginnings of this in the book, and I would trace them back to the enclosures, particularly in England in the 18th century. You only get a capitalist system when effectively the land is stolen from common people and enclosed in the hands of a few numbers. The rest of us have to go into the factories, which is what happened to my ancestors. You then have a concentration of power. That causes a concentration of wealth, and that leads to effectively the global system we have now, because you take that out into the colonies. I'm more of a Chestertonian distributist myself. I would like to see... I don't have a problem with markets and making and selling and things like that, but it's the concentration of power and wealth in the capitalist system that is part of the progress of the machine, because you couldn't have developed these technologies without that. It's not possible to do it. So again, you've got this kind of infernal desire for more, which is at the heart of the worst of the capitalist
project. It's at the heart of the worst of capitalism, but I would say that it needn't be. In other words, I think it depends. Capitalism is one of those capacious terms where we could spend hours talking about it. I don't know enough, actually, about it to spend hours talking about it, but I guess people who read your book, and I hope people will, they can figure that part out. But what one of the things that has come into the conversation now, because you talk about technology, it's this new thing, and now it's about technology. We're trying to immanentize the eschaton, try to achieve utopia through technology. Globalization is another new thing. This idea that nations are somehow a backward idea. And I laughed when I read, because I've said it so many times, people act as though Hitler invented nationalism and that any sense of patriotism is Hitlerian, you know. And I think, no, actually, George Washington loved his country and, you know, he was the antithesis of Hitler in many ways. So, but it is funny how that's happened. And so now there's this rush to eliminate borders and to eliminate... You mentioned place as one of the things, that pride of place, that there's something healthy about loving one's hometown or one's country. There can be some, we know how it can go wrong, but people cease to talk about how it can go right.
Yeah, well, a lot of people confuse hearth and home with blood and soil.
Yes.
Very different things.
Yes.
Very different things. I think we're still in the shadow of Nazism and fascism, and so people are extremely paranoid about that, which is not a bad thing to be paranoid about either, but, you know... Yeah, within limits. I mean, so what you have if you want to talk about, say, Hitler and the Nazis and the fascists, these are machine ideologies, right? These are deeply centralized, extremely industrialized, very technologized, extremely oppressive systems of top-down power, which decide that they're going to create a utopian system of kind of nationalist or racist perfection and then impose it on everyone with fleets of bombers and marching columns, which are extremely machine-like. It's a very, very different thing from a kind of Wendell Berry-esque love of home, or indeed a Jeffersonian way of being an American. I mean, I would say, to come back to the capitalist point, you get globalization when you get global capitalism. So that's, this spreads this economic and cultural system around the world. And there's a section in the book in which I try to draw out the commonalities between corporate capitalism and sort of radical left progressivism, because they're both utopian ideologies which point you in the same place. So you don't ultimately want to be governed by a strong centralized government, whether it's fascist or communist, or a set of unaccountable giant capitalist corporations that can drops technology down onto you. Right from the beginning of my political life, such as it is, I've always been a localist. I think that the solution to all of these problems, however much you like capitalism or communism or whatever your politics is to bring things home to the local level. The more that we can govern ourselves at the village level, at the community level, wherever we are and whoever we are, the more power we have, which is why distributed power is the way forward. It's very difficult to get it because the tendency of both capitalism and the state is always towards the center.
Well, I mean, I would argue, I'm writing a book on the American Revolution now, and I've thought a lot about this, and that the founders of the United States, they understood this, and they understood that we have to guard against federal power, of national power, that we want to keep things as local as possible. So we have to institute buffers. We have to have checks and balances because we're aware of this tendency. And I think we've been failing at it, and we have to go back, at least in the United States, because the federal government has grown horrifically like a parasite that's bigger than the host. And I'm with you on the idea of the smaller, the better, the local. I don't know. Just because we've never discussed it at Socrates in the City, give us a thumbnail version of Chestertonian distributism.
Chesterton's such an interesting writer. He's a very paradoxical English Catholic who wasn't originally a Catholic, became a Catholic later on. Fascinating, paradoxical figure. So Chesterton is he's coming at it from kind of Catholic social teaching, but he's a man who believes that both communism, and he's writing at the height of kind of Bolshevism and the communist revolution, communism and capitalism are oppressive systems. So he says, on the one hand, you have this overpowerful, overweening state which just crushes you down in the name of equality and revolution. And on the other hand, you have, in a country like England, concentration of land ownership, huge corporations destroying, for example, the local economy of small towns with their enormous supermarkets and their huge trading systems crushing the small farmers because the farmers can't compete with them. So you've got these two oppressive systems. And everybody's sort of asked to choose between the two of them. Are you left or right?
Right.
But they're both crushing the local level. So Chesterton's fantastical desire, which he sort of admitted, Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc, his friend, his French, Anglo-French friend, his kind of fantastical, slightly Tolkien-esque desire, which is a great idea which may never happen, is a system he called distributism. And his fantasy is that you distribute... Land is the source of power, right? So you take all the land in England and you distribute it equally to everybody. Everyone gets a bit of land. They get 3 acres and a cow, as he called it. And then they can do what they want with that. And that's not a system in which the state is collectivizing everything and forcing everyone to do anything. Neither is it a system in which economic power has become so concentrated in giant corporations that the little guy has no chance at all. It's a system in which you go, okay, everyone has the equal amount, start there, see what happens. So it's a way of, it's almost a thought experiment as much as anything else, but it's a way of saying what would happen if you localized economic power as well as political power so that people had a chance to come together and build things at the local level. And that's what I've always been in favor of, and it's why I don't like capitalism, but it's also why I don't like the European Union. It's why I don't like overmighty states. It's also, and this is a point Chesterton makes, which is really important, this is also the way that most human societies have actually always existed to some degree. Maybe the property isn't equally distributed, but before the modern era, you don't have giant centralized states, and neither do you have these enormous world-spanning corporations. You have trade, you know, you have people trading at the local level, you have government to some degree, but you have nothing like you have now. I mean, the most powerful medieval tyrannical monarch in England had nothing like the level of power that our democratic governments do now to survey us, to tax us, to monitor us, to control us, to put us in vast prisons, to get us into their armies. So it's really a vision of localization, which to me has always been the thing that inspires me. And you're right about the interesting thing about America is, I think right at the beginning of it, there is that kind of Jeffersonian agricultural vision, which then gets superseded by this big monstrous thing that is now squatting over everybody. But there's, if there's any chance of a human life again, I think we have to focus on the human level, things at the human scale. And it doesn't matter whether you consider yourself to be left or right or anything else. Everybody wants a human scale life in their community, and they want some power in their community to decide what happens there. That's something that actually unites everybody wherever they are, I think. And it's the thing that we constantly struggle for, because it's all, the power is always being sucked upwards.
Well, I mean, one way I would describe what you're talking about is freedom, liberty, self-government. But we have to pay a price for that. It's easier to go along with the machine, so to speak. We have to be have some courage and willingness to fight for that, to maintain that. Benjamin Franklin famously said, leaving the Constitutional Convention, when he was asked, "What have you given us, Dr. Franklin, a monarchy or a republic?" He said, "A republic, madam, if you can keep it." In other words, keeping it requires something. And if we don't do anything, we will get some kind of tyranny, which is what you're describing.
And what it would require now, wherever you are in the world, is some sacrifice as well. Because, you know, the things that the machine gives us are ease and comfort, right? So if you want your T-shirts manufactured in a sweatshop in Bangladesh that cost you 50 pence, or your fantastic iPhones full of cobalt mined by African children, all the other stuff you get from the global system, if you wanted real localization and real liberty, you'd have to say no to some of those things. If you want to reject the global system, reject the machine, you have to live a simpler, less technological life, which involves more work, but probably also more fulfillment and more power. So it's like anything else. So if you give people power, they have to use it responsibly. At the moment, it's easier for us to let the companies and the government do everything for us and give us goodies instead. But if we were going to take responsibility, it would require some decisions to be made about what we want and what we don't as well, which is hard, but probably necessary.
In the book, I underlined a sentence. You say, patriotism, Christianity, cultural conservatism, sexual modesty, even a mild nostalgia for the English countryside, or a love of once canonical novels, all are more or less verboten, and the attitude toward them is rapidly hardening. That's interesting to me, how things fall along certain lines, and that that people who are against, we mentioned, you know, patriotism, they can't think of a healthy patriotism. They have a very hidebound negative view of Christian faith, sexual modesty. It is interesting because this has been happening over decades. You know, it obviously started in the 20s in a big way, but you can trace it back and back and back. But it is interesting how it has crept over time until there are many people that seem to be quite sure that these are all bad things.
Yeah, I mean, the modern revolution is really a revolution against the things that we once would have regarded as traditional, for right or wrong, better or worse, which in the West is these kind of Christian values and these particular understandings of place and culture. I tell you what's interesting, though, is that I think almost even since I wrote those sentences, there's a bit of a turning back towards some of these things.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be careful with these things. You have to not idolize them. You have to not idolize nations and patriotism or even the church. Otherwise, you end up just not seeing the forest for the trees. But I know, because people write to me all the time, especially young people, that there's such a meaning crisis now that people are feeling, okay, yeah, we've got all this stuff, great, but what is anything? What is the meaning of anything? Where should I be going? And just in the last few years, the number of people going back to church, for example, especially young men, is really significant. Don't know how long that will last, what exactly will happen, but there's a search for meaning. And it's almost like there's been a modern revolution, and you could, one of the things I try and do in the book is suggest that the kind of the political right and the political left both have their versions of this revolution, of the stripping away of meaning, whether it's through the progress of global capitalism or whether it's kind of through woke progressivism that tries to demolish and decentralize and disengage with everything traditional. All of it's kind of a war against rooted, normal human life. And that's the end. Again, you have to do that before the machine can progress. You have to strip away all the things that would normally make us human so that you can create this giant technological replacement for it. But I have a kind of strange faith that actually we want to remain human. And I'm starting to see, and I think I'm not the only one, that there is a turning against this. Because the more people understand it and think about it, which is what I'm trying to do in the book, the more they say, no, this is wrong, what do we do instead? And they may come up with different answers, but there's a pushback against this worldview of deconstruction now. Because there's only so much you can deconstruct everything and leave it all over the floor and not replace it with something else. The problem with a deconstructionist modern or postmodern worldview is it's very, very good at taking everything apart, questioning it, making everything relativist, but it doesn't have a big picture to put in its place. So, okay, great, you destroyed Christianity. What are you going to put? What have we got instead? What have you got for us? You know, yeah. Okay, you told us we shouldn't be rooted to our places because that makes us Nazis. Well, what have you got instead? You know, what have you got? What have you got for us? And what you've got is the machine. What you've got is this globalized technocratic vision in which we move towards the silicon perfection, and it is inhuman. And I don't think most people who are engaging in the politics of the left or even the politics of the capitalist right are thinking like that. They're not trying to push us in that direction. But the end point of a society in which everything is deconstructed is that there is nothing left. And we're just kind of naked in the face of this technocracy that's rising instead. So when we get to that point, which we're getting to now, people start to turn around and say, maybe we shouldn't have deconstructed everything. Perhaps we need to look at what to rebuild again.
Well, even when you talk about inhuman, right? We have always understood inhuman to be a bad thing. But if you don't define human as a good thing, then inhuman is not a bad thing. And so we have to make a decision. What does it mean to be human? Are we created in the image of God? Are we loved by God? Or are we nothing? Or are we machines that can be changed? And obviously the transhumanist movement, they don't believe there's such a thing as human. And they are, in a way, what we've seen, you describe it in the book and everybody's been living through it, we really do see a war on the human, which to my mind, if human beings are made in the image of God, it's a war on God. It's a war on what God loves. And it's a desire to unmake, as you say in your subtitle, what God has made. It's this idea that we're at war with this reality that God has created. So if you're a human being, you know, what can we do? And it goes back to Mary Shelley, whom you mentioned, and Frankenstein. Somehow it's a war on the human person, in some ways physically and in other ways. But it's a war on humanity. It says that we don't know what human beings are, or whatever it is, it's not so great, and we can do better. And so we are going to deconstruct it.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, and it's the point that's very difficult to talk about in kind of public life in the mainstream. To a transhumanist, humanity is something to be transcended, hence the name, transhumanism. It's a stage. And you know, they talk openly about humanity being a stage in evolution, and now we're creating the next stage, which will be silicon-based rather than carbon-based, which will be more efficient, which can create greater technologies. So that's, we're creating the things that will surpass us, and that's all good. That's evolution in action. And that's the most extreme end of what is happening with artificial intelligence. AI is supposed to be, at least general AI, is supposed to be the thing that does that. And because there is no understanding of what we actually think a human is, there's no agreed understanding, or even whether that's a good thing, then that conversation will continue. Now, if you think a human is made in the image of God, which you do if you're a Christian, then surpassing humanity is... You know, trying to replace humanity is an inherently evil or destructive or stupid thing to do. Whereas if you think humanity is just an imperfect thing which happens to have evolved in a particular way and can therefore be improved upon, then, well, it makes logical sense to improve upon it. Why not? If you've got the technology, let's make sure that we don't suffer and we can live forever. So it's exactly the actual essence of the question is, yeah, what does it mean to be human? Is that good? And that actually is a religious question. It's always been a religious question. Whatever answer you come down on, unless you're a pure materialist, and even then that's almost a religious answer.
Yeah.
Nothing has meaning. Everything is just material matter that got here by accident. That's still, that's a philosophical, if not a religious answer.
And evolution itself is a religion, although the Darwinian evolutionists would writhe at being labeled as religious, but the fact is...
Well, it's certainly an origin story.
It is. Absolutely. Well, it's an origin story. It's more than an origin story. I mean, they've taken it by faith, and they will impose it as a narrative on everything. And what we're talking about here is the imposition of that narrative, that everything is evolving in a positive direction. And if not, we can help it evolve more quickly and further in a positive direction so that we can be as gods effectively. But what if we go backwards, it's still an idea that there is no such thing as meaning, although they rarely are able to say that. That's what they're saying. In other words, they're saying that there is nothing. Meaning is to look for meaning is just it's an evolutionary quirk. There's no such thing as meaning, and we have to bravely march on in the face of meaninglessness.
Well, of course, Darwin himself was a Christian. This is the irony of this, and his evolutionary theory is not what it's often represented as, which is often represented as a kind of progressive theory of, you know, as you say, we move forward, improving. That's not what evolution is. The evolutionary theory that Darwin puts forward and Wallace put forward are just that creatures evolve by filling ecological niches. That's neither good nor bad. You know, you just do the thing that happens to suit the ecology and then it moves forward. It doesn't inherently make things better. But we've got a sort of progressive in the broadest sense, not in the sense of just being left-wing, but in the sense of believing in a motion of progress that we apply to that theory and we say, well, nature is evolving and humans are evolving and we're evolving towards this point of perfection, and this is where the technology comes in. We say, well, great, the technology allows us now to evolve faster and to evolve better. So we're always moving forwards towards a meaning, a place of perfection. And again, that then raises the question, is it possible for humans to kind of evolve morally or ethically, or are we actually basically the same creatures we were 1,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago, just with better machines? And again, what does it mean to be human? That's what this comes down to. If you can talk about technology and capitalism and politics and the rest of it, you can talk about AI. At the root of all of it is that question: what does it mean to be a human being? And if, depending on what view you have on that question, you have to choose a stance against the machine or indeed in favor of it. So certainly if you're a Christian and you believe that we're made in the image of God, you have to take a pretty clear stance against people who think we're going to replace ourselves and build God, which is the thing that's at the root of the system that's evolving around us at the moment.
Well, I think that those who seem to believe that there's nothing transcendent about human beings have to deal with the idea that if that's true, there's nothing immoral about the communist Chinese murdering political prisoners and using their organs to help the people that they like. There's nothing immoral about that. There is no meaning. There is no good or evil. They're not really open or honest about that.
Well, I think that the ironic thing about this is that most revolutionary movements are Christian at heart. So because they come from the West, you can look at the essence of Marxism and say it's actually built on a Christian worldview. So they have a strong sense of morality. But it's not a transcendent morality. The sense of morality that's built into it is that all human life is valuable and totally equal. And therefore, you know, that which is a Christian idea, fundamentally,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
All human life is equal in the eyes of God. And all human life is sacred if you're a Christian. And if you turn that into a political ideology, then it becomes what we've had in the last century. But what happens, the way that gets twisted is that you end up saying, well, look, things are not perfect at the moment. We have to make them perfect. That's going to involve a revolution and a lot of wrenching, and there are probably going to be a lot of people that have to be kind of put over here, and we'll justify it by calling them kulaks or saying that they're counter-revolutionaries or something, and it's okay to liquidate them. Which is why you always, again, come back to the human scale. You have to start at the human scale, or from a Christian perspective, you have to start with your neighbour who you're told to love. I always find it interesting that Christ tells us to love our neighbour and not to love humanity as a kind of abstract thing. You have to love the person whose eyes you're looking into because they're created by God. And if you're actually trying to behave like that, you can't really liquidate whole masses of people either in the name of the master race or the utopian communist society. The minute you're dealing with giant abstract systems that tell you that you can move towards perfection if you do this thing, then you're on the road to tyranny, right? The only way to avoid tyranny as much as you can in an imperfect world full of fallen human beings is to try and relate to actual human beings at the local level, which is the only way you can ever relate to them. As soon as we're into fighting over giant abstractions, it gets horrific.
Paul Johnson, in his book Intellectuals, makes this case over and over and over. He points to people who preached about, you know, loving mankind, but who treated their families extremely poorly. You just see it over and over. So that's a very important.
It's very common, you know.
Point to make that.
It's the temptation for all of us because we like ideas. So we can say, oh, I've got this grand idea, and it's terrific, and I'm going to tell you what it is, and it's going to lead to this great utopian, perfect world. But, yeah, what are you actually doing in your community, in your life, when you go to confession? How much of yourself are you looking at? You know, because that's harder, actually. Trying to be a Christian human being is really hard, and having a grand idea is really easy. And I know because I've had lots of them. That's where that leads you. So, yeah, and this is, for me, having been on a kind of very long spiritual journey that ended up in the Christian church unexpectedly. That's what the solution to all of this has come down to. People always say, well, what's the solution to this machine? What do we do? What do we do? And I say, well, if you're a Christian anyway, I can only speak as a Christian, you know what to do, actually. You know how to live. We knew that 2,000 years ago. Now we have to try and do it. If we were actually all living the way we were told to live in the Gospels, we couldn't have built this thing. Actually, so we could, because it's a giant monstrosity of power and wealth that we're not supposed to be pursuing. It's an idol, basically.
Right. Yeah, well, actually, yeah, it's the ultimate idol.
It is.
I mean, as I was reading the book more and more, I thought, this is, we're talking about Antichrist. It's very creepy.
Well,
it's horrific.
Yes. Yeah, I'm always trying to skirt around that, but my great suspicion is that that's actually what's being constructed.
Well, no, you skirt around it. There's no need to be explicit about it, but it seems inevitable to me. I've thought about these things a lot, so it was very interesting to me to see how you talk about it. Let me ask you, since you mentioned becoming a Christian, can you describe what that process was like for you?
Well, it starts off for me on a very long journey that began when I was a young man or a young child, actually, and I fell in love with nature and had very Wordsworthian and transcendent experiences in nature, which I still do, which I think now are experiences of God in creation, which leads me to be an environmental activist for many years when I was young, because I wanted to protect that sense that there was something sacred in creation from the machine. And if you spend enough time trying to save the world, coming up with political ideas, looking through all the ideologies, trying to come up with grand schemes and looking at the economics and the politics, eventually you dig down enough to realize it's a spiritual matter, in the sense that it's that question of what it means to be human, what the earth is. So I went on a long spiritual journey. I didn't come from any kind of Christian or even religious family, so I did what a lot of Western people who are a bit lost do, and I went to the East and I became a Buddhist for a while, which taught me a lot, but there was something missing. And the something missing was God, it turned out. So then I went looking in kind of nature paganism. I went all over the place, and then I just had only about 6 or 7 years ago, I had a number of experiences. I wrote an essay called The Cross and the Machine, which goes into this bit in a bit more detail. It's published in First Things magazine. I had a number of experiences which kind of forced me, a bit like C.S. Lewis again, against my will, dragged sort of towards the Christian church, dragged towards Christ. And the more I started to understand what the Christian story actually was, as opposed to the thing I thought it was, the more it made a lot more sense to me. And actually the sense that the big picture story, that the ultimate story of Christianity, is that humanity is in rebellion against God and has always been in rebellion against God. And that we have a way home through what Christ does and says is a story that makes a great deal of sense to me, particularly when I look at what's actually going on in the world today. We're in constant rebellion against God and against our own humanity and against creation and the rest of the world. But there is something we can do about that. So I ended up, as I say, in the Christian church 5 or 6 years ago, which has been quite revelatory. And interestingly, I'm really fascinated by the apocalypse, not in the sense of the end of the world, although that's always fascinating, but in the sense of what the word means, because the word means unveiling and revelation. So in that sense, we are living in apocalyptic times, because a lot of things are being unveiled about what we're actually doing. We can just look out there and say, oh, right, okay, this is where we are now. Here's an unveiling. When things are unveiled, you have to say, okay, what am I going to do? If you're a Christian, you know the answer to the question. You've got your great commandment, and you've got the path to follow. So it's it's comforting. There's work involved to try and make yourself an actual Christian as opposed to just somebody who says they're one. But
that's the whole thing. You mentioned, you know, Marxism and many of the things come out of a Christian worldview, or sometimes the people promulgating the most wicked ideas do so under the illusion that they're being actual Christians or something. Then the question is, what does it really mean to be a Christian?
Well, that's the question the church has struggled with for 2,000 years, and plenty of Christians have done strangely evil things in the name of Christianity as well.
Correct.
It's funny how that keeps happening, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, look, to me, it all comes down to humility, doesn't it? This is certainly the teachings of the Orthodox Church, and I'm sure it is of the Catholic Church as well. It comes back to what Christ always tells you. You love God, you love your neighbour, you humble yourself, you don't judge others. And if you're actually behaving like that, which is very hard, but perhaps you can manage it for 10 seconds a day, but you're always walking towards it, then, as I say, it's impossible to become too hubristic and evil. But it's a constant struggle, isn't it? It's a struggle against yourself.
I don't normally look at my phone, forgive me.
It's ironic, isn't it?
Today, in fact, I've never done this before.
Oh, dear.
So it's right that I'm doing it as I speak to you. This is true, actually. Today, someone who doesn't normally email me, you mentioned Wordsworth, emailed me nothing but Wordsworth's famous poem, "The World Is Too Much With Us." And I wasn't planning on reading it, but it seems particularly appropriate.
I think you should.
The world is too much with us, late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We have given our hearts away, a sordid boon. This sea that bears her bosom to the moon, the winds that will be howling at all hours and are upgathered now like sleeping flowers. For this, for everything, we are out of tune. It moves us not. Great God, I'd rather be a pagan suckled in a creed outworn. So might I, standing on this pleasant lea, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn, have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreathed horn. Somehow, this reminds me of C.S. Lewis, and I think you and I, who have an appreciation for what the classical pagans appreciated, which many modern Christians have lost. And that, to me, reading this poem this morning, again, sent to me by someone who doesn't typically send me emails or poetry of any kind, I thought it sums up a lot of what you're saying in this book.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, look, it's one of the reasons I thought I didn't like Christianity was that it had no sense of nature and it had no sense of love for creation, which actually isn't true, but it's true of some manifestations of it, but it isn't true at the root of it. And one of the reasons I went rummaging around in paganism, as so many people do, is that we have a sense that we're completely alienated from nature and sucked into this machine, and you want a faith and a spiritual path that can say to you, nature is alive. Christianity doesn't seem to say that. Now, actually, it does, if you go to the root of it, in my view. And actually, that's one of my next books can be about that. But Christianity needs to be alive, and it needs to be alive with a pulsing love of creation as well as a pulsing love of God. And I think that means it needs to be critical of the machine society that's being created around us. It needs to give us a sense of, you know, the beauty and power of creation, the creation of people and what we can be at our best as opposed to our worst, and the creation of the world which we're eating with this giant machine. And often, as you say, it doesn't do that. It becomes a sort of political or dry or intellectual thing that just alienates and bores people. But at its root, it's not that. And it wasn't that at the beginning. And it wasn't that to the Desert Fathers. And it wasn't that to the Apostles. It's this wonderful promise of a world renewed, which, you know, if you actually get to the root of it, it's a beautiful vision. But we've just, being fallen, we've managed to corrupt it and make it boring and evil repeatedly over human history. But also, it's always renewing itself, isn't it, the Christian story? It's always popping up again in different forms. So we've got an opportunity to dig into it now and say, what does it actually mean at its root as the machine rises around us?
And I think that's why I love C.S. Lewis so much, because it's his brand of Christianity. He pulls us back to the best of the classical pagan world in the way that Wordsworth is trying to do in that poem.
And
I think particularly now we need that.
We do. Yeah, well, Lewis was always being called a pagan, and he sort of didn't mind. You know, because this, it depends what you mean by pagan,
doesn't
it? But, you know, if you're talking about a society that, yes, has this rich love of nature and wildness and then it's all there in those traditions, and they may not have Christ, but they have that understanding. If you become a Christian who's lost sight of that vision that Wordsworth's talking about there, then you're missing, I think, half of what the world is. And then you just create this dry, desiccated thing, which is one reason the modern world has walked away from it.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about the rebellion against Christianity. Yeah. We complain about that. One of the reasons is that Christianity lost sight of what it was supposed to be, tied itself into power, became oppressive and boring, and people looked at it, including me when I was younger, and said, I don't think that's got anything to do with the God I saw up on the mountains when I was a child.
Hmm.
You can see God in the forest. You can see God on the mountains. You have to be able to see the same God in the church.
Well, I think we'll have to leave it there. Paul Kingsnorth, author of Against the Machine on the Unmaking of Humanity, thank you for being my guest.
Thank you.